2, 3, 4.
I think a good teacher is someone that comes to school not for the fact that they're getting paid, and they come to school for the student.
It's a boy thing.
What I think makes a good teacher is a teacher that's willing to connect with their students, make an effort to get to know their students.
It's a boy thing.
Like, when the teacher's approachable and you don't feel intimidated when you go up to talk to them.
It's a boy thing. So, Bags, I think we're going to talk about Scholarship English.
Yeah, I'm interested to talk about Scholarship English because I am running a Scholarship English, pardon me, tutorial club, whatever word you want to put with it. And it's, I love Scholarship English, like I really enjoy it, and it's such a stimulating thing to partake in. But it's just interesting to think about the ways in which we approach it, I guess. And so that's why I want to talk about Scholarship English and your thoughts around it, particularly the unfamiliar text question or component of it, because obviously you're a guru at that. But also because one of my boys, I was talking about, well, one of the boys in the tutorial on Friday, I was talking about how they use the time. And I said, you should use the 3-hour exam 1 hour per section, the 3 sections. And if anything, usually I find that students will dedicate less time in a normal exam situation to unfamiliar text and probably more to the writing of the essays. But one student did say that he would do it the other way and give more to the unfamiliar text and less time to the essays, which I advised against. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts.
Should we explain to people what Scholarship English is?
Just in case. Sorry, I've gone like real rapid fire because you've got kids coming soon. The bell's going to go here shortly and I have to get out of my classroom and go down the concrete stairwell, which is so noisy at OB's. You might remember that. I do remember.
Okay, well, Scholarship English just briefly is a advanced examination in New Zealand that we offer to students who want to demonstrate real high levels of ability in the subject and interest in the subject and engagement with literature. And it's really great, I agree, wonderful thing, because it allows us to kind of, the students as much as us, to spread our wings in the subject and really engage in ways that are kind of unrestricted compared to other processes of assessment, which can be quite limiting for the kids. Obviously, as most schools, if students choose to voluntarily sign up for Scholarship English, we typically will then have to set up ourselves voluntarily tutorial programs in order to support them so that they can do that extra assessment at the end of the year. And it's made up of 3 papers, and we're talking about one of them, which is the unfamiliar text paper.
3 sections. Section A is like looking, comparing unfamiliar text to text and the features they use in answer to a statement that you're provided with. Section B is obviously more genre focused. So again, statements that are quite open-ended, aren't they? You could go any way with them. You agree or disagree with the statement, but again, it might be on Shakespearean literature, it could be on poetry, it could be on certain film things, whatever. And then section C is all literature, as long as you don't repeat the same material or points you've made from section B. So B and C are essays, but A is actually an essay as well. So,
yeah, I find it interesting that they use the word genre for section B because it's more text type. But I think genre is a word that has multiple interpretations, but they call it genre, don't they, quite often?
They do call it genre, and the reality is it's not, though, because it's not like we're looking at dystopias or horror or whatever. It is actually, they're very specific in what they're asking you to unpack. So,
yeah. So you're actually discussing a text type rather than a genre of text, I think. But, you know, that's what they call it. What I often say to students in NCEA assessments is that they should evenly allocate their time across all the papers, except I acknowledge that there's reading time for the unfamiliar text.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I say calculate it, but add yourself 7 or 10 minutes properly to read the unfamiliar texts and then divide the rest of the time up by 3. So I'm saying essentially roughly, you know, 55 minutes per paper with that 10 minute for reading as well. And that's how I suggest to do it. I love how now you're in the stairwell. Oh, look at that stairwell. So there's the answer to the time question. So how do you go about getting the students kind of in the right place to do the unfam?
I guess I get the students to go through, read the text, find the language features, think about the effect that's created, and then how, what is the overall intent that they realise from that, and how does that relate to the statement that's been posed to them by NZQA?
That's a good summary, isn't it, of the process they've got to go through. I definitely have, especially, when we had to teach the entire cohort at Mount Aspiring College because all the teachers fell over. So we were teaching unfamiliar texts to 180 students in one classroom. But
I'm sitting shaking my head. I didn't do that. I did the essay writing component, remember? So I was teaching other students at that point in time. But then, that with Renee. But yes.
That's when I reduced it to a formula because, and when I say 180 students, I don't think I'm exaggerating, am I?
You just would have had my class out of there.
Yeah.
So there would have been 25 with me.
So I think answering in the NCEA exams on unfamiliar text can be reduced to a formula. You can kind of reverse engineer the marking schedule, but I'm genuinely against that in terms of how to do good teaching. Mm. And so what I spend time with the scholarship guys for us, I run a group that I just call English Scholars, and that we have scheduled slots in a week, and anyone can come to English Scholars from year 9 to year 13. And there's usually about 45 students signed up for English Scholars. So they come and I also say, come if you want to come, but if you don't want to come, don't come. Just, it's totally a voluntary thing. And so I have a kind of steady number of around 23, 27 turn up each time to each session. And so it's an ongoing enrichment of English experience, the English Scholars. I don't actually run an English Scholarship tutorial program, if that makes sense. So those English Scholars will then sometimes opt into sitting the scholarship exam. And I structure the teaching in English Scholars around the kinds of skills and knowledge and experience and kind of thought processes that would serve them in scholarship. So it does get them there, but not quite as directly as most scholarship tutorials would, which I think literally kind of do that reverse engineering of the test, like here's the test and these are the things you need to be able to do to pass the test, which I try to stay away from as much as I can.
Can I add in there that that's not, I wouldn't say that that's how I approach it, but I think it's interesting to put in there that point though, like how I've historically run scholarship English tutorials is that I get the students to end up being the teacher. So they might have to choose a question, for example, and unpack it and how they approached it. And the last few weeks, what we've done is they've chosen questions and thought about the ambiguities of the words or the different ways they could approach it. And then we sit there and we go off on massive tangents through my questioning of them and challenging them to see things in a different way. Yes, I can see that lots of people would go, here's the marking rubric, what are the things we need to do, this is what you've got to tick off, whereas I try to stimulate them probably a little bit in the same way that you do, but in a very short time period. It's not a club that goes over years, really. But in getting them to be quite open and with their thinking.
Yeah, and it is about, isn't it, just asking them to expand their thinking to the greatest extent whilst at the same time being precise in their response to a given statement and recruiting really strong evidence from the texts that they've read or that they've been presented with. I think that the most important part of working with students in preparation for scholarship is the open-endedness, although I don't think that that's a necessary thing. It's just a thing I think is important. I think there are lots of ways to get students ready for it. I think you could give them a textbook about how to do well in scholarship and that would work too, but because it's often just to do with the students themselves being interested enough. So I guess one of the things I'm probably trying to do with my scholarship crew is just keep them interested in English. An incidental thing, I just jumped off a cliff the other day in my classroom where I put in front of the students in level 3 the last year's examination paper for unfamiliar texts, a model answer that they provided from last year, an excellence response, and I hadn't read it. I just thought, let's read this together and interrogate the model answer. Let's see what they did that the markers said was so good. And I honestly think that this model answer that they chose, well, it kind of has the content that's needed to pass the assessment, completely misapprehended the poem. And I kind of don't know why we're sharing model answers off of Monash nationally that has a student who, while they technically succeeded in meeting the criteria for excellence, completely kind of didn't grasp the kind of central ideas of the text. And I don't know, it just seemed, it was crazy to me. And it was really interesting trying to manage that with the class, because as I was reading it, I was becoming more and more kind of troubled by what I was reading. And anyway, we had some fun in the end.
That's not usually your style to do that. It's interesting that you did that you showed one of the model answers that NCQA has provided, because I know that, again, that's not what you do. It is interesting when you do look at the ones that they've given excellence to, whether it's even for an essay, a lot of them are not what we would expect our students to do, in terms of maybe it's missing the point, but a lot of the time it's also they're below what our expectations are.
The reason that we looked at it is I was trying to take a shortcut, because we haven't spent any time and we're currently in their practice exam week. Mm. I just wanted them to have an understanding of what's required of them when they sit the exam next week. So let's look at an answer so that we can see what people do when they're given these questions, because you haven't had a chance to look at this because I've been too busy teaching you. So like basically no exam revision happened in my classroom except for that. And I'm very happy about the fact that that's the case, but I also, I have to manage their anxiety because they're walking into an exam they've never seen before.
So that's where you went to. That's where you went to. And this is why this happened. But
yeah,
it's quite good though. It's good when you can pull things apart with kids though. You know?
It was great. I think they were as shocked as I was with the level of misapprehension of the poem that was shown. And at the same time, unfortunately, it doesn't matter with these students because they were perfectly capable of operating as you and I would operate. So, but at the same time, problematically, it kind of feeds the narrative, which I hate about English, that you can literally say anything you like as long as you can justify it, which I do not think is true. And I hate the idea that they've been presented with a model answer that literally does that, that kind of argues a false case and gets an excellence.
Okay, so there's that. And then I'm just thinking, so what do you do with unfamiliar text? Then how do you teach it for scholarship?
I think the main driver, so first of all, I teach it by everything we've been talking about, by richly teaching and focusing on the mechanisms of language for the 5 years we have them. So I think that every one of our students could sit their scholarship exam at the end if they wanted to from their mainstream classes. Like, it isn't a special scholarship program that would deliver that. It's our teaching in English that should deliver that.
I agree with you. I don't think that it should be like a special thing. It's actually our program should be extending our learners. Cool. Just had to add that point.
Yeah, so there's that, which means you don't have to run extra programs, which is why the fact that I have an extra thing, the focus is really just on offering students to have more time engaging in English with each
other.
Stimulation, like that.
Yeah.
And the year nines in that group are just as capable of participating in the conversation as the year 13s are.
That's a nice cultural thing. Yeah, that's like a lovely culture, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And they do. They look after each other and they give each other advice. And then the juniors, because they don't actually sit the external, because I've been told I'm not allowed to do that anymore, because what was happening is that we were getting year 10s who were getting scholarship and it was kind of upending the system a little bit, so I'm not allowed to do that anymore. But they kind of, it's good because they're kind of cheering the senior students on when they go into the exam, because they've all been working together on their kind of engagement with English. When I'm talking about what we might do when we're discussing unfamiliar texts specifically in that English scholars group, I tried really hard to develop conversations about the, you know, how you're talking about the effect, which is obviously what the question is asking, you know, what effect do various language choices make? I try and get them to just interrogate, and it's really hard to articulate and get them to understand. I want them to interrogate the effect, not that the specific piece of language does, but that language will do. So when you do this, it will have this effect. Like, the use of a relative clause will put two pieces of information, two ideas or components of an idea, into parity with each other. Whereas if you use a complex sentence, you know, main clause and a subordinate clause, then that's going to put a hierarchy into that sentence. Like, it's about thinking about the language at a really deeply structural level, and then having things that you could expect to infer from those choices in language, and then reading the text to see how the author has done that, and then discussing the author's actual intentions. And that's the bit that was missing from the exemplar that we looked at, is that they'd kind of lost track of what the author was trying to say with the text. They were so busy analyzing the effects that they'd seen, and they kind of constructed an whole alternative narrative about what the piece of writing is. But I will not allow that from my students. They have to remain close to the truth of the text. And then, of course, the statement just becomes a stimulus to discussing a component of that, because otherwise it'd be too much to ask them to explain everything about the text in a one-hour session. And that's kind of how we do it, I suppose, if there's any clarity there.
No, there is, but I really like that, because it's going back a step further is what you're asking them to do, really. It's not what is the effect of the personification in this piece. It's actually, why would you use personification? What does it achieve, right?
That's a much clearer way of explaining what I just said. It's as simple as that, Bags, like that. Unfortunately, I don't seem to have the kind of precision to be able to say it like that, but that is it. It's like, you might identify personification, and of course you would, but you don't just sit there at that present moment with this present text. You just think about personification as a process and what kind of things you usually or generally would be aiming to achieve when you invoke that process. Because then, of course, it allows them to do the golden thing, which is to talk about things that are done exceptionally, like unusually, or to discuss the originality of that choice in this context.
I like that a lot. I'm thinking, I mean, this is just a moment of, you know, gold for me, just getting your brain on it, because you are really great with lots of things to do with English, but actually when it comes to unfamiliar texts, like, it's an area that you excel in. I think also you're talking about the golden thing, or the things that are done unusually. I think it's really important also, and I keep saying it to these students that I've got in this scholarship group, that you want to approach your response or crafting your responses in any of those sections, but particularly B and C, where you can bring in your knowledge of a text holistically, organically, because I think, yeah, it's actually about sitting there in that moment and going, what is that asking me? What does that mean? Mm. How can I apply my texts, plural, to that? Mm. And how do I respond, rather than, okay, here's not necessarily a rote learned response, but this is how I'm going to do it, and I'm going to find something I can manipulate to do that. No. That's not what we want. But we also don't want that at level two or level three.
Again, none of this is actually any different to any other level of English, just from my point of view. Yeah. I thought, just because we've both got to go, I thought I'd try and summarize a little bit by saying two things. One is, I do love the interrogation of the details in English, and I love those big global conversations. But I think if you're giving some acknowledgement to me for my interest in the interrogation of the kind of structure of language, I have to give you credit for your strengths in building in the classroom those really rich discussions. It's a real talent of yours, and it's partly driven by persona, but it's also just a skill. So I thought maybe next time we could talk about how you do that. Like, how do you build that discussion in a classroom setting amongst students around an idea where they're really engaging themselves in the discussion, not just following leads? Could we talk about that next time?
We could, and actually it's even been happening with my year 9 class around our film Uproar, so yeah, we can, and it's cool, it's exciting. So
let's do that. And I don't think I've expressed myself well today, but
we should just,
people can make of that what they will.
No, I think that we should have a moment of going, Chris is in, he had parent interviews this week or yesterday, as well as practice exams, and you had your basketball team win their section, and you're off to tournament week down here in Dunedin. Yeah. I'm seeing you obviously next week. You got a lot on.
There's so quite a lot on for us right now, isn't there?
It's hilarious. I know. I feel it. So, and you've got kids lining up outside. So go get them in.
Well, lovely to see you as always. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. And I'll see you next week in the flesh.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
All right.
Okay.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
It's a Boy Thing, a fortnightly chat about teaching English to boys with Gina and Chris.
It's when the teacher doesn't treat the students like their students, like they treat them like they're kind of like colleagues.
I think what makes a good teacher is clear set deadlines, good communication, willingness to like go over topics that some of us might find confusing,